Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Great. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Caroline Bryant. I'm the Deputy Director of Networks at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on the Digital Services Act and Global Free Speech. Our moderator today is Professor Maimon Schwarzschild. Professor Maimon is a professor of law at the University of San Diego, an affiliated professor at the University of Haifa. After our speakers give their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. That, Professor, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Caroline. There has been major legislation in Europe very recently governing or attempting to govern media, especially digital media, with significant implications for freedom of expression and of public debate, not only in Europe, but with possibly very serious implications for media platforms and for the public at large in the US as well. Some of this legislation originates in Britain, the UK's Online Safety Act 2023, and an older but still pending Communications Act in Britain are examples. But there's even more important legislation emanating from the European Union in Brussels as well. The EU's Digital Services Act, DSA, applies to major digital platforms offering services to users in the EU, regardless of where the company is based, including US companies, which indeed is most of them. EU officials say that the DSA is needed to protect democracy from misinformation, disinformation, and hate speech online. Service providers that fail to comply with EU requirements risk fines of up to 6% of global annual revenue, which could easily run into hundreds of millions or even billions of euros and dollars. In Washington, in Congress, very recently, the House Judiciary Committee issued a report by its Republican majority warning that European regulators could use the DSA to chill speech, suppress political dissent, and establish a global censorship regime. By contrast, House Judiciary Democrats say the EU law includes procedural safeguards, judicial oversight of content moderation, and democratic accountability, at least within the EU. Will the EU law make the Brussels bureaucracy the new global censor of the digital public square? Could it, along with other policies in the EU and perhaps in the UK as well, export European hate speech laws, which already are used against individuals peacefully expressing their views, beyond Europe and to the US? We are very fortunate to have a panel of very knowledgeable people to explain the EU law and policy, and to explore the implications for American online media, for access to information, and to public debate for Americans, and what, if anything, the American legal and public policy response should be. So let me introduce our panelists. Stéphane Bonichaud is an avocat, a barrister in France. He has a double degree in French and German law from the universities of Cologne and from the Sorbonne in Paris. He also has a master's degree from the London School of Economics as well. He's a member of the law firm of Briard and Bonichaud in Paris, and he's very knowledgeable about EU law and practice. Dr. Adina Portaru is senior counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom International based in Brussels. Dr. Portaru engages frequently with EU institutions and practices before the European Court of Human Rights in landmark human rights cases. Dr. Portaru is admitted to the Bucharest Bar and is the editor of the 2020 book, A Precious Asset, Analyzing Religious Freedom Protections in Europe. The book is published by Kairos Press and is available online. By all means, look it up. Berin Soka is president of Tech Freedom, a think tank that has studied internet law and regulation since he launched it in 2011. He has a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Virginia and a master's in European law from the University of Paris. He is writing a PhD at Dublin City University, comparing how U.S. and EU regulation affect online platforms and how each system is vulnerable to abuse. Finally, John David Rosenthal is an independent scholar and journalist with a background in political philosophy who has been covering EU politics for a wide variety of media and journals for at least two decades. He has taught on the faculties of Rutgers and Colorado in this country, as well as at the École Normale Supérieure in Lyon in France. He has a PhD from the New School for Social Research in New York and did graduate work at the University of Chicago and at the Free University in Berlin. He is fluent in German and French and keeps up in other European languages as well. He's the author of an important and widely noted essay in the Claremont Review of Books, spring 2025, entitled Make Speech Free Again, How the U.S. Can Defeat EU Censorship. Welcome to all. I'd like to turn to Maître Bonichot first. Can you give us, Stéphane, a brief overview of the EU, of the DSA, the EU Digital Services Act?
Yes, thank you, Professor. Hello, everyone. So I want first to thank the Federal Society for organizing this panel about the European Digital Services Act and how it deals with free speech. First, what is the Digital Services Act? In the European system, you have a difference between a regulation and a directive. A directive sets goal, not details. The directive lays down objectives that all European countries must achieve, but each country decides how to implement them in its national law. A regulation, this is much stronger. It is directly binding and member states cannot change the content. It applies as it is written. The Digital Services Act is not a directive. This is a regulation, which is directly binding for all member states. So this is something very important in European law. Now, why do we have this new regulation, which applies since 2024? The Digital Services Act wants to contribute to the proper functioning of the internal market for intermediary services by setting out harmonized rules for a safe and trusted online place. To summarize, this regulation wants to protect fundamental rights in the online area. This regulation sets rules for intermediary services, but what does it mean? In the regulation, intermediary services are defined like this. This is internet providers, hosting services like clouds, online platforms, or very large online platforms, or very large online search engine. So there is four categories of companies which are concerned by this regulation. When we speak about very large online platforms or very large online search engine, it means that this is company which have more than 45 million monthly users in the EU. So this is a very broad companies. Now that we have explained what and why we have the DSA, let's talk about the content of the DSA. The intermediary services have mainly four obligations according to the DSA. Firstly, they have to provide a contact point in Europe on, if outside Europe, a legal representative. Secondly, they have to publish clear terms and conditions for users. Thirdly, they have to set up a notice and action mechanism for illegal content. And fourthly, very large online platforms have to mitigate systemic risk. And this is one big point. What are systemic risks? And we will speak about this. Systemic risk, this is also defined by the regulation. This is everything which concerns hate speech, misinformation, disinformation, fake news, and that kind of content. But this is not defined in a more precise way. So we'll maybe discuss now about this and the consequences of this lack of definition. One last very important thing about the DSA is that it applies for all companies around the world. It doesn't matter whether the company is located in Europe or in the US. From the one, if they have services here in Europe, they have to follow that rules. And if not, the Commission can investigate and eventually decide to give fines to the companies which don't respect the rules.
That's very helpful. Dr. Portaru, what are the implications of this for freedom of speech and debate, first of all, in the European Union countries themselves?
Sure. So as it was mentioned before, the scope and the effect of the DSA on free speech are global, wide, and long-lasting. We speak of the DSA not only as a blueprint for so-called speech moderation in Europe, but for the entire world. Now, as it was mentioned before, the DSA requires platforms to remove illegal content, which it broadly defines as anything that is not in compliance with EU law or the law of any member state. You can find this definition in Article 3H of the DSA. The issue is that given the vast array of anti-speech laws throughout EU countries, the DSA allows the most speech-limiting laws in any individual country to restrict speech across the entire bloc and even worldwide. So what happens in this scenario? Under the Act, the European Commission can impose crippling fines of up to 6% of global annual turnover on platforms that refuse to limit content, which could amount essentially to billions of euros. The Commission can also restrict access to a platform within the EU or suspend its operations, showing the massive power that the DSA gives over private companies. And since the companies are threatened with huge fines if they do not limit enough content or censor enough speech, and there is no penalty whatsoever for censoring too much speech, what do we expect these companies will end up doing over time? Going back to the issue of extraterritoriality, I just want to give an example that comes from the practice of our organization, ADF International, the case of Finnish parliamentarian Päivi Räsänen. 6 years ago, she posted a picture of a Bible verse and expressed her Christian views on sexuality on X. She was criminally prosecuted for alleged hate speech and has unanimously been acquitted in two trials. The issue is, however, that the state prosecutor appealed the case again, and shockingly in her case, in which she faces trial for posting online, she is facing a new trial before Finland's Supreme Court due in October of this year. This hasn't happened during DSA's entry into force, but if this was the case, because we're speaking about a post which happened online on X, the content that Päivi posted in Finland could be assessed throughout the legal standards of any country of the European Union. Some of the people listening to us know that in Germany, for example, it is illegal to insult a politician. Let's say you have a political commentator, a satirical content creator in the US, criticizing Ursula von der Leyen, who is a German politician, but also happens to be the president of the European Commission. Now, that kind of content could be challenged, could be flagged as potentially illegal content in Germany, according to the German laws. So we speak about the content that takes place in the US or any other country on a US platform that gets challenged according to German law and potentially can be challenged and taken down in Germany. And potentially, if we can have a bit more time to discuss in the entire European Union and outside the European Union, we have cases before the Court of Justice of the European Union, which clearly states that there is an open door for worldwide takedowns based on existing regulation of digital content online.
Dr. Soka, a little bit proleptically, EU officials say the DSA is no threat to legitimate free expression. I must say, in my experience, EU officials are very reluctant to appear in any forum where they might confront knowledgeable critics of the DSA. So when they say the DSA is no threat, they seldom seem to say it in any forum where they're likely to be challenged. Nonetheless, are they right that it's no threat to freedom of expression and debate?
I'm not a doctor, but I have to be precise about this.
I suggested that proleptic. You're studying for a doctorate, so we can assume you're going to get there.
So there are a few different concerns here, and we should try to unpack them separately. So, first of all, we have to be clear that the DSA doesn't make anything illegal. That is a task for member states. And as I think it's important to note here for everyone in the audience, the union has only the powers that are conferred upon it. So the DSA doesn't confer any powers to make content unlawful. That task and power remains in the hands, as I said, of each parliament of the member state. The next question that was raised is about whether, yes, it's true the DSA requires removal of content that is unlawful. And then the question becomes, what is the geographic scope of that removal order? I will speak mostly to not this question, but it is not my understanding that those removals have to be effective throughout the entire union. I think that they, in fact, are supposed to be proportionate and applied in the country in which the speech is unlawful. But that's not primarily what this debate is about. And I don't think it's primarily what Americans are interested in. What the House Judiciary Committee report was about, what the hearing that happened before that committee 2 or 3 weeks ago was about, was rather the claim that the DSA requires takedown of speech and specifically censorship of certain disfavored political speech outside of Europe. So that's the question that I have focused on. And if you want a good thorough analysis of that, I would refer you to the letter that I helped organize that was led by Martin Husevic, who has written the best article on this topic. He is, I think, it's fair to say, the leading scholar of the DSA. His book, Principles of the DSA, will answer your questions comprehensively. And his article on this topic, The DSA's Red Line, is really the authoritative thing to read. And it's notable that piece wasn't cited at all in the Republican staff House Judiciary Committee report. They merely assert both that the DSA has a geographic effect outside of Europe and that it requires removal of specific speech. And as our letter explains, neither of those things is true. So with respect to unlawful content, that's one category, the DSA explicitly, the commission has said, and explicitly that the DSA has effect only inside Europe. But that's also not specifically what we're mostly talking about here today. We're talking about what happens to lawful content that it might be disfavored. And in that area, I think there is a problem. There is a gap in the DSA. It doesn't say this explicitly, but as our letter explains, I think it's actually quite clear that the DSA does have this red line, as Martin puts it, that it may not be used in a content-specific way. And here, it's important to unpack more specifically what we're talking about in the obligations under the DSA. So we referred earlier to the risk mitigation obligation in Article 35. So if you are a large, very large online platform or search engine, you have an obligation to mitigate systemic risks. But that obligation is secondary in terms of the timing of things to your broader obligation under Article 34 to assess systemic risks. And this is where I think the problem arises, because that obligation is quite broad. I mean, it includes all the things that have been mentioned, disinformation, and the categories of systemic risks are very open-ended. They include risks to electoral processes and civic discourse. And I find it troubling that those terms are so open-ended. But the Article 35 obligation, which is the one that actually has teeth, that's what you have to do about systemic risks, is much narrower. And this is where the red line comes in. It cannot possibly be interpreted to require a site to take down a particular lawful content, to restrict lawful content. And the reason is, as we explain in our letter, is threefold. The commission has never been granted the power to do that. Second, it's very clear under European fundamental rights law that if you are to restrict free expression, which that would, it would be a restriction upon free speech of some users, that under European law must be explicit. And the Digital Services Act does not say that explicitly. And then finally, there is this question about the allocation of decision making between the commission and the parliament that is sort of checks and balances. Once again, the parliament did not confer that power. So what does that leave us with? It means that, yes, you have a very broad risk mitigation, risk assessment obligation under Article 34. But under Article 35, whatever obligation you have, whatever the commission might fault you for before it imposes penalties, it can't be content specific. It has to be content agnostic. And so that could include things like how you design the registration mechanism of your service. What does the interface look like? The law is deliberately open-ended about those things. It did not do what the digital laws have previously done, like the privacy law, the GDPR, which was very prescriptive. Instead, it leaves these things open, and it's up to the company to decide how to mitigate whatever risks it has identified. And then importantly, there's a safeguard here. The commission, before it brings an enforcement action, it has to say exactly what it thinks you did wrong and what you should do differently. And when it does that, the commission bears the burden of defining that what it's proposing is proportionate. So it has to go through this analysis. And we haven't seen that yet. The commission did bring an enforcement action against X regarding the adequacy of community notes, which maybe we could talk about. And importantly, the commission hasn't acted on that part of that investigation. And I think this is why, because I think they'd have a very difficult time explaining what it was that X should have done differently that would be consistent with that red line. The last thing I would say here is it is in some ways understandable that people are very concerned about the DSA, because if you are outside of Europe and outside of European law, and all you know about the DSA is what you heard Thierry Breton say about it, Thierry Breton tried to use the DSA to censor Donald Trump's speech. When Elon Musk interviewed Trump, Thierry Breton, who was then the commissioner responsible for enforcing the DSA, on a letter and on Twitter, suggested that he could bring enforcement actions against X under the DSA merely for hosting a conversation with Trump. That's absurd. That obviously crosses the DSA's red line. And he was fired for that. He was condemned by me, by other civil society groups. We put in a letter at the time saying this is not what the DSA authorizes. And before he could formally be fired, after having been condemned by all of his fellow commissioners, he pre-resigned, or the president of the commission could fire him. So this is just to say that, yes, these laws can always be abused. Jawboning, the threats not based on law are always a problem. It's happening here in the United States right now as we speak. And in the United States, there's no correction for this. The administration is perfectly willing to jawbone companies to do things that are unlawful. In Europe, when that happened, the commissioner responsible was fired. And so to that extent, I think the European system is working better than the US system.
Well, let me put a question or two to you. Is it a defense of the DSA to say that the DSA itself or Brussels doesn't make anything illegal? It's the member states that do so. There are now 27 states. Until a few years ago, there were 28. There are 27 states in the EU. The most restrictive of them is going to be quite restrictive of freedom of expression, of free speech. If the EU is enforcing in principle with respect only to that state, but technically once something is improper to post in state A, it's going to be very difficult to make it available and visible in state B without satisfying state A that you're keeping it off the internet. So if the most restrictive state is the state whose law Brussels is going to enforce, is it anything reassuring for us to be told that Brussels itself isn't making these laws, it's the member states that are doing so?
Well, again, that's a distinct concern from the extraterritorial effect and the censorship issue. And again, I don't think that that's accurate. And I would refer you to Martin's work. I think DSA itself requires those removals to be effective in the states in which the law applies. Because the reason is very simple. It would not be proportionate to require otherwise. I mean, the law applies in in each state, the takedown is proportionate because Germany's laws require X. That is not the case. Otherwise, you could imagine some harder cases where, for example, there might be a speech regarding an election in Romania, and the question is what happens in other states. But I think, you know, we just saw that happen. We just had this exact fact pattern play out, and what we saw was that Romania was able to enforce its laws regarding misinformation about its election inside Romania and not outside Romania. And the voting patterns reflected that Romanians living outside Romania got very different information because they were not subject to restrictions issued by the Romanian government.
Dr. Rosenthal, let me turn to you. Is it possible to technically to take down something that's illegal in state A and still make it available, in other words, not affect its visibility and its prominence and its availability in states B through Q?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not a tech person. I'm the last person in the world who should be regarded as a tech person. However, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and we can look at what the so-called DSA transparency reports that all the major platforms falling under the DSA are required to publish, I believe it's once a year, maybe it's more frequently actually. And those reports show that certain content is in fact geo-blocked. I think that's what Baron is referring to. So they're not really removed per se. The content is not removed per se. It's just geo-blocked, presumably, in the jurisdiction, the relevant jurisdiction. However, if you look at X's first, I actually think they're published a couple of times a year, at least in the case of X. If you look at X's first DSA transparency report, actually there are more removals than blocks. And there's a third category, which to me is the most important category, and that I don't believe we've touched upon yet, at least not in any detail, and that's visibility restriction. And that, I think, is the greatest problem in terms of the global effects of the DSA. So if there's a block, that block will be geospecific. If there's a takedown, at least it's something that's visible and that we know about, but already in the codes which preceded the DSA, most notably the Code of Practice on Disinformation from 2022, which was the strengthened version, there was already a 2018 version, there's already talk not of removing content which is not illegal. So illegal content has to be at least blocked in the relevant jurisdiction. Maybe it doesn't have to be, but it may in fact be removed all around Europe and all around the world. We know there are cases of that because we see that in the DSA transparency reports data, but there's the other option, or the third option, merely of restricting, not illegal content, but restricting so-called legal but harmful content. And that's where, to my mind, things get extremely sticky, extremely complicated, and where you see the real extraterritorial consequences. But the problem is, again, we don't know when it's happening. If you go back to the COVID period, when so-called COVID misinformation or disinformation was being censored. And I would say, contrary to the narrative that's taken hold in the states, and I think even in DC and even in among members of the House Judiciary Committee, the driving force behind the censorship of COVID disinformation or misinformation, and that in quotes, was never the Biden administration. We know that, among other things, because it already began when Donald Trump was still president in 2020. It already began. The driving force was already the EU, the European Commission, and the driving force, even though it was not yet law, was already the DSA, because the DSA was proposed as law already in December 2019. In mid-2020, the European Commission creates a program for so-called monitoring or combating COVID-19 disinformation. And that's created under the aegis of the Code of Practice on Disinformation. All the signatories of the Code of Practice on Disinformation are required to provide data to report back to the Commission, to provide monthly data, later bi-monthly data, on what they're taking down and on the accounts that they're suspending. So you have actual data from X saying, okay, in July 2020, we removed so many items of content and we suspended so many hundreds of accounts. But that was all something that we were seeing, okay? You could see the misleading labels, for instance, on posts on Twitter, and you could see when an account was suspended. But sort of the default option now for dealing with disinformation is not removal, precisely because it's not illegal. The default option is, in order to mitigate the systemic risks that Stefan talked about, you have to limit the virality of that so-called misinformation. And that's something which X and all the other platforms are supposed to be doing algorithmically. And what's being done algorithmically, we don't see. And that, to me, is the main problem. It's happening, and it's presumably happening all around the world, but we can't see it.
First of all, what's the difference between illegal speech and harmful speech? That seems to be a distinction that the DSA is making. And I take it your suggestion is that illegal speech has to be formally removed, and it's
or blocked,
and it's publicly ascertainable what it is that's being removed. Harmful speech doesn't have to be removed, but its visibility has to be suppressed, and right. There isn't any public information about what is being what the platforms are being muscled in effect to make less visible. As a practical matter, if something is less visible, to what extent are people who want to get information and want to participate in the debate, to what extent are they going to be able to see whatever it is whose visibility is being suppressed?
They might not be at all. If you look, the X in its DSA transparency reports, it links its so-called enforcement options. So again, you have three options. One option is global blocking, global takedowns. Second options is geo-blocking. So what Baron was referring to, just removing in the relevant jurisdiction. And the third option is visibility filtering. And X mentions that you can stop a post from being even shown to followers of a given account. So it won't be shown to followers of a given account. It won't be shown to non-followers of a given account. It will be demoted in replies. It will just be available as a unique URL. You can go to the profile and find it, but unless you go directly to the profile of the account user, you can't find it. So they can actually completely squash, they can make something invisible, simply put.
Suppose I'm a digital company and I'm told, well, you have to block or suppress something with respect to one country. So if Germany prohibits criticizing saying bad things about German politicians, I take it some German politicians, not all of them, not BDF politicians, I take it you can say what you like about them. If Germany prohibits that, and I'm a tech company, is it, what are the incentives for me? Do I have to worry about a risk that if something is visible anywhere in the EU, that people in Germany might see it and that might be illegal or that might subject me to penalties of various kinds, sanctions of various kinds from the EU? Is my incentive to play it safe and take it down everywhere?
I think maybe others might want to address this, but I think evidently your incentive is to take it down everywhere. I can give another example from German law. There is a prohibition in German law, one could say maybe understandably so, on using so-called anti-constitutional symbols. So anti-constitutional symbols are namely National Socialist symbols, so using the swastika or using the so-called Hitler salute. A German retiree by the name of Stefan Niehoff, this is the same guy who was actually had his home raided for having insulted Robert Habeck, who's a Green Party politician. That charge was dropped, but he was eventually convicted of quote-unquote using anti-constitutional symbols in tweets. But he hadn't used those symbols. He had just shown historical photos of, for instance, clergymen under the Third Reich using the Hitler salute. Okay, he wasn't using them himself. He was critically using these photographs from the period of the Third Reich. I think it's evident that anywhere in the world that Twitter is going to be or Facebook is going to now be sensitive, knowing that in Germany, if those images are shown, it's a crime, is going to be sensitive to showing even historical photos of people using the Hitler salute. And I had direct experience of this because, or at least of the kind of chilling effect, let's put it that way. When I tried to publish an article, which eventually did get published by the European Conservative, but when I tried to publish an article on the Stefan Niehoff case, what I wanted to do was show his tweets, to show people how unproblematic they would be outside of Germany. And I had a lot of trouble publishing that article. Why? Because I was showing those same historical pictures that Niehoff showed of historical figures from the period of the Third Reich using the Hitler salute.
Mr. Scola, is it unfair to suggest that the most restrictive policy is going to be the one that bleeds out into the way the internet is regulated in the EU, across the EU, and even beyond?
Well, let me say, just to start with, as a German-American dual national, I'm not here to defend exactly where Germany has drawn the line. And I think John and I would probably agree about the examples that he just cited being examples of Germany going too far and enforcing its own laws. But that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about the DSA and how the DSA works. So I think we have to be really precise about this. So the DSA, Article 9, requires, it governs how orders work for restriction of access. And in particular, Article 9B, I think, is the critical one where it says that the territorial scope of those orders has to be limited to what is strictly necessary to reach its objective. So, you know, I don't want to say categorically that those could never have extraterritorial effect outside of a particular member state, but as a general matter, they don't. So now let's go to the other thing we've been talking about, which is risk mitigation. That's Article 35. So Article 35 refers to four broad categories of risks. One of those is unlawful content. So you have to analyze the unlawful content part under both things. But then there's a bunch of other stuff in there, like civic discourse and electoral processes. And that's where this conversation starts to go off the rails, because in part what John and others are responding to is people in Europe, some people in positions of power, not just Thierry Breton, but other people who are around the commission, wanted the DSA to be an anti-disinformation law. And they talk about it that way. And in particular, I think it's worth just quoting this one sentence from Thierry Breton in July when he went after Donald Trump, where he asserted that Article 35 imposed duties regarding, quote, the amplification of harmful content, term that you used earlier, in connection with relevant events, including live streaming that might increase the risk profile of X and generate detrimental effects on civic discourse and public security. Okay, so Thierry Breton claimed that the DSA could be used to censor lawful content by reducing its visibility or access, including Donald Trump talking about whatever. That's nonsense. The DSA doesn't even include the term harmful content, except as a passing reference to the very narrow category that is recognized in Europe and in the United States for content that is lawful in general, but harmful to children. Okay, so the first way that Thierry Breton went wrong is, the DSA really, in these provisions we've been talking about, content is either unlawful or it's not. But the harmfulness is just, that's not a thing. So we've discussed what happens with content that is unlawful. And again, I think it's limited in its effect, those orders, certainly to Europe and generally to each member state. And then the question is, it was asserted a few moments ago that that companies have an obligation to mitigate systemic risks by reducing the visibility of disinformation, in particular, like claims about an election. And again, I think that's not correct because of the DSA's red line, because that would be a content-specific restriction. And if that's what had been authorized here explicitly, we might be having that conversation. It's not explicit. And because it's not explicit, there is no European court that will uphold a content-specific restriction. So the restrictions might be things like, you know, in general, you should design your sign up differently. In general, for the particular kind of content that you, or for all of the content on your site, you should consider certain features. But it's up to the services to decide what those risk mitigation features are. And the commission cannot impose liability because the site didn't restrict access to particular kinds of disfavored content, period. That's the red line.
Dr. Portaro, are you reassured?
Yes, I just actually was listening very carefully and I wanted to intervene a couple of times. I think what was mentioned before was certainly clear on what is limited to what is strictly necessary. That's true. That's what the DSA says. However, it does say about the extraterritorial impact, effect, coordination between the digital service coordinators, and just the internet by its nature, of course, is global. So we have to look at the DSA in its whole ensemble. So both the articles and the recitals, there are various references to both what is strictly necessary and then what is extraterritorial. Also, I think it is fair to look at the objectives of the DSA, which is to mitigate systemic risk, to remove illegal content, using very loose interpretation. So these objectives are so sweeping that the limitation on what is strictly necessary is actually not reassuring. The DSA opens the door to regulatory measures with a scope that is limited only by the imagination of political actors in play. And I do agree the Commission does not directly say what is legal or illegal. However, it has created a structure and the Commission is at the top of the structure. So I think it is a little bit simplistic to say that the Commission has nothing to do with potentially the removal of legal content or content that is deemed to be harmful in the mitigation of risks obligation, just because the Commission itself, by A to B, is not removing that content. So if we look at the DSA as a whole, the DSA puts in place a censorship industrial complex. We have the DSA. This year, we have had a number of codes of conduct that were passed, misinformation, electoral toolkit, guidelines on protection of minors. So this is piling up and it creates a mega structure of more than 100 pages, all in all, with the European Commission once again at its head. In Brussels, where I'm based, I take part quite a lot in the meetings, in the hearings that take place in the European Parliament, where the DSA progress is being discussed. What I hear from the companies is that they do receive a lot of content that is flagged extraterritorially. So it can be one content that is visible, of course, in 27 countries or even across the European Union, they can get 10, 15 like content from different countries. And of course, they have to decide according to that specific law. The practice is, of course, the geo-blocking at first will go to a global blocking because no company is going to employ that many people to study that many requests for that many laws according to different interpretations and standards. Yes, the Commission does not directly put the label legal or illegal. It is, in the end, the companies through their own services and terms, but it is done through the DSA that is enforced and reinforced and restressed by the European Commission. And in the end, it is a business model. I mean, we also have to mention this. It is depending on finding content to censor and inconsistent with the standards of the rule of law. When you look at, for example, this was very briefly mentioned, and I tried to squeeze all of this in due time to leave some time for questions and answers. During a crisis moments, the DSA mentions that the Commission can actually take extra powers regarding the very large online platforms and search engines. And those extra powers, and I would encourage the academics here would go so far as to override the judiciary in member states' countries. So I would encourage to see the Commission is not the judiciary power. However, it does become so in a crisis management. And this is also deeply concerning. And maybe lastly, to the point of Thierry Breton, yes, everyone, I think, in the space recognize and criticize the reach that took place there. But that is not a single incident that happened. Actually, in 2025, after the elections in the US, there was inauguration speech delay, famous moment happening in my country of residence in Belgium. The Belgian state broadcaster imposed a 2-minute delay on airing President Trump's inaugural address, not for translation, but to pre-screen everything that the team might deem racist or xenophobic. So mitigation of risk, illegal content, let's put this into the wider picture, because this is not necessarily only a matter of free speech in Europe or in the US. It is really a global blueprint for censorship.
What would you say, all of you, before we turn to questions, to Europeans who might say, look, we have a different history and a different balance of freedom and constraint than the US has. In Germany and elsewhere, for example, our history means that anything smacking of Nazism is illegal. Songs, symbols, speeches. These might be protected by the First Amendment in the US, but you mustn't impose this on us Europeans. Is that a fair point on the part of the Europeans? And if so, in an increasingly global media environment, what do you do about that?
Can I take this first? Because I have to sign off a little early. I apologize. As a transatlantic person, I live in both worlds. I spend most of my time on free speech law in the US. They're different systems. I'm critical of abuse in both. In general, I think that the American system of allowing more speech is the right one. But, you know, my grandparents grew up in Nazi Germany. I understand why Germany has written the laws that it has. I understand why the Belgian broadcaster might have done what it did. But to use that example, they did what they did in that example that was just provided to you, not because of the DSA. They did it because of Belgian law or because of their own editorial judgments. We need to be really clear about what we're talking about here, that Europe, the European Union does not have the capacity to make these decisions. And despite these efforts to portray the DSA as a sort of harmonization of how these things happen in Europe, in fact, these decisions are still made at the national level. I can disagree with some of them. We can have a separate discussion about some countries going too far and whether
Sorry, just for the legal part, that's correct. But again, for the risk mitigation part, no.
Well, and John, I'll close with this. On the risk mitigation part, the red line is, to the view of myself and 31 other scholars of the Digital Services Act, is very clear and rests on very clear principles of EU law, even though it was not put into the DSA, which we asked them to do. We want this to be articulated clearly. We want the Commission to embrace this. But it is, in fact, clear in European law that the Commission, whatever it can do with the DSA, it cannot impose liability because someone failed to mitigate a particular kind of content. That is the red line. So what was mentioned earlier about the disinformation codes of conduct and so on and so forth, if companies are signing on to that voluntarily, it's not because they're afraid of being held to have a risk mitigation obligation to remove that content, period. You cannot blame the DSA for that.
But sorry, I mean, Baron, it's too bad to have a debate when you need to leave. But why then would when the strengthened code of practice on disinformation is published, and I believe it was June or July, in any case, mid-2022, why does then the Commission itself, maybe you're saying the Commission is understanding the implications of the law. In some ways, I think that's correct. The Commission did misunderstand the implications of some aspects of the law. But the Commission at that point says, okay, we have this strengthened code of practice of disinformation, and now we have an enforcement mechanism. It explicitly says this in a tweet. We have an enforcement mechanism. If the companies that are signatories of the code of practice do not comply with their commitments, and there are 44 commitments, as you know, under the code of practice, then they're going to get slapped potentially with these 6% fines. And again, that's not me. That's a commission tweet. So why do they say that? Does that mean, each company individually is going to decide what it thinks is information and what it thinks is disinformation? Of course, they have no competence for doing that. I would say, and I think you would agree, the European Commission doesn't have competence for doing that either. But it can't possibly mean that. There must be some sort of contentual, content-based aspect. If, for instance, Twitter came back to the commission and said, look, we took down 50 tweets in such and such a month, and they were tweets by the commission about the efficacy of COVID-19 vaccines, because we think that's misinformation. Do you think that would be satisfying then the commission's expectations?
Okay, so just to be clear, we just switched to a different provision of the DSA. So we're no longer talking about, I don't want everyone to understand here that this is how these pieces fit together. So first we talked about orders to take down unlawful content.
No, I'm not talking about orders
for content. No, I know. I'm just making sure everyone understands how the pieces fit together, right? And then we talked about the risk mitigation obligations, which are the core of the DSA. And now we're talking about companies committing to do something and not doing it, right? So that's correct.
But again, I'm saying the commission, and I agree with you in a way, the commission misunderstood what they were doing. But the commission says, well, now we have an enforcement mechanism, and those commitments are no longer voluntary, they're mandatory. I agree. If you say no, they're not mandatory, I would agree with you. But nonetheless, the commission is saying that, which means it thinks that it's putting pressure on the platforms to limit the effects as systematic risk of certain misinformation. And I think the whole problem is, what exactly is misinformation and disinformation? You can't deny that a focal point of the first von der Leyen commission is misinformation and disinformation. They were talking about that the whole time. You might say,
Just to take advantage also of Berin being here, if I understand correctly, what you're asking, John, is actually the role of the commission. It's not about illegal content or lawful content being there or mitigation of risks or algorithmic or, companies being signed on. I think the point that John is asking or is making is, what is the role of the commission? Is the commission simply a neutral actor that has proposed this legislation, that has gone through member states and now sits back and just watches and intervenes in egregious situations for enforcement, or is it actually an active player that comes here, gives statements, encourages platforms? The commissioner comes and says, you can run, but you can't hide, even if you just unsubscribe from the code of conduct on this information. So I think my understanding, John, from what you were asking, the overarching question is, what is the role of the commission in all of this, in practice, not only in theory?
Yeah, so I do have to go, but just to answer your question, DSA is very clear. First of all, there's no direct fines for failing to live up to a voluntary code. And more specifically, what the commission is supposed to do is take into account noncompliance with the code in assessing the Article 35 risk mitigation obligations. Once again, you return to the DSA's red line. The commission either has the power to make content-specific judgments about content that you should have restricted access to, or it doesn't. And again, the scholarly consensus on this is the commission has no such power. I really encourage everyone to read Martin's article. You can read our letter, which goes into this in some detail. And I would just note in closing, since this was all started by the House Judiciary Committee staff report, the staff report rests almost entirely on this claim that the DSA can be used in content-specific ways, and it fails to engage completely with the scholarship on this topic explaining why that is not the case. And in that sense, it is not a serious contribution to the discussion. But on that note, I apologize. I have to go for a previously scheduled meeting. So pleasure to chat with all of you. And I hope you can refer everyone to the letter that I've put forward. We filed it in the House Judiciary Committee site, and maybe it'll be in the links for this episode.
Let me thank you very much, Berin, for joining us. And let me turn to the audience and to those of you online who might have questions And you might, through your questions, let us know whether you are reassured or otherwise about the potential effects of not just the DSA, but this entire architecture of European policy and law and regulation, not just on Europeans, but on people wanting to participate in public debate across the world, and in particular in the US. If we have questions, Caroline, can we turn to those at this point?
Absolutely. So I think we have one question. Are flagging agencies in various MS, and I apologize, I don't know what the abbreviation stands for there, but diverse in ideology. France leans towards progressivist only agencies, pro-immigration, pro-abortion, LGBT activists, etc. Other question, where do MS stand in terms of enforcement? It is my understanding some are really reluctant to abide. Any thoughts?
Dr. Rosenthal?
About the first question, in terms of the flagging agencies, they're certainly not ideologically diverse, but they in fact haven't yet had much of an impact. And I think the crucial fact about the flagging agencies
can you explain what a flagging agency is?
Yeah, so
flagging is.
Yeah, so one of the the central pillars, we could say, of the DSA is you're supposed to have this notification mechanism where individual users can notify Twitter or Facebook or whatever the platform happens to be of what they take to be, say, hate speech or disinformation or whatever. And then the platform is supposed to make some sort of judgment itself and potentially take enforcement action. In addition to individual users being able to do this, governments can do this under, I believe it's Article 9, Adina, that they can, I can't remember, it's Article 9 or Article 8, that they can actually give something like, they're not exactly orders, but take down requests. And you have the creation of this new entity, which are called trusted flaggers. The trusted flaggers are organizations which are supposed to have special expertise in certain areas. So, for instance, one of the German organizations that has been given trusted flagger status is called, I believe, Hate Aid. So it's supposed to be specialized in hate speech, and any flagged content that's been submitted by a trusted flagger has to be given priority treatment by the platforms. But those trusted flaggers don't just sort of emerge out of the blue. They're appointed. You can, as an association or an organization, you can apply for that status. But it's the respective government that actually names those trusted flaggers. And if you look, recently I've been looking at a lot of the data you can glean from these so-called transparency reports. And in fact, the trusted flaggers up to now, in any case, have very little impact. But, you know, they're not going to be any more ideologically diverse than the governments that they're appointing them, so to say.
Yeah, yes, I will add something. It's something very important, trusted flaggers, even if for now it has not a very big impact. But it also means that an association with a political views could be designated as a trusted flaggers and try to influence the decision or the behavior of providers or hosting companies. So it could be used in the future.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we.
I totally agree. Yeah, and in fact, in the German case, this hate aid, of course, they want to go after, for instance, parties like the AfD. So who defines what is actually hate speech? But again, it's not those private associations that have maybe those political agendas. It could be the governments that are appointing them. And the second question I didn't hear, I'll leave it to somebody else to answer.
And no, there's another question as well that maybe we want to get through. Right. Now we only have a little bit of time, but so I think someone's wondering about the importance of civil discourse and its role in the United States and American freedoms, kind of also in French freedom and maybe potentially in the UK. He says the language used for those examples could be considered aggressive and unlawful maybe, but kind of didn't that move things forward in the United States kind of debate? Any thoughts on that maybe for US, France, and the UK?
Just a point. In the DSA, the DSA refers to the European Convention for Human Rights and the Charter for Fundamental Rights of the European Union. So normally it should protect freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And in the idea of the DSA, I don't say that it would be used in a proper way. But in the idea, we always have to make a balance of interest between a freedom of speech and the hate speech or harmful speech. So this is the idea behind this regulation. And the European Convention of Human Rights is explicitly quoted in the regulation.
It's a global, increasingly a global media environment, and balancing off the very different national cultures and national legal environments in a non-national and increasingly global world is clearly going to be both very difficult and with the risk that it cascades down to the most restrictive country or the most restrictive regime. And how that will be managed in a country like the U.S., where First Amendment values have, on the whole, up to now prevailed for open debate and for broad freedom of expression. That, I think, is going to be a continuing challenge. And the DSA, the Digital Services Act, as one element in a European structure, which emerges from a very different political and historical culture. How that will all be managed, I think, is going to be of continuing, ongoing interest in this country, both in Congress and in the country more at large. So I think this has been extremely enlightening and extremely valuable. I'm grateful to all the participants in this conversation. But I think the conversation will continue in the Federalist Society and far beyond as time goes on. So many thanks to all of you and to Caroline. Let me give it back to you.
Great. Well, I just want to echo Professor Maimon's thanks. Thank you also for bearing with me as I had some technical challenges. But on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. And thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.